Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Christopher Patterson, and I am the host of this podcast, New Books in Asian American Studies. Today, we are joined by Ellen Wu, who is an assistant professor of history and American studies at Indiana University. Today, we will discuss her book, The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority, which was published by Princeton University Press in January of 2014. The Color of Success charts the complex emergence of the model minority myth in fashioning Asian American stereotypes throughout the 20th century. Wu investigates how inclusion of Asian Americans rather than exclusion can still reproduce racist attitudes and, in effect, reproduced exploitation and violence onto other communities of color. In doing so, Professor Wu reinterprets the model minority myth as less a way of comparing Asians with whites, but also as a way of characterizing Asian Americans as definitively not black. Ellen, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. Could you begin the interview by describing the intellectual trajectory that brought you to write the book Color of Success and what kind of made you interested in the first place in Asian American studies?
Sure. Well, I am what I call a second generation Hoosier Chino. So I am Chinese American and my parents immigrated to North America in the 1960s and then eventually found their way to Indiana in the early 1970s. So I grew up in Indianapolis within a Chinese community, but it was a very small one. Mm. Although we attended a Chinese church every Sunday, and I also had the opportunity to go to Chinese school on the weekends as well. And so for me, I guess I could say that my intellectual trajectory for this book began, I would say, in college. I attended Indiana University Bloomington as an undergrad. And my second year at IU, I took this course that was sort of this experimental course that was essentially an introduction to Asian American studies. So at the time, Asian American studies wasn't a permanent or regular part of the college curriculum. It was just kind of, you know, here and there somebody might teach a class. But for me, it was really great. It was so eye-opening. And, you know, I learned in that class about so many concepts and, you know, I got to watch films and read literature and learn this history that I really had not been exposed to before. And one of the key concepts that we learned in this class, this course, which was taught by a woman, and I believe she's a professor now, named Yuko Kurahashi, she taught us about the so-called, you know, model minority stereotype. Hmm. And for me, it was like a light bulb went off because it helped to explain things that I had observed just growing up in terms of the ways that people I lived around, how they stereotyped or understood, you know, Asian Americans. And I think that makes sense because the people that, you know, growing up in a place like the Midwest, that didn't have in Indiana didn't necessarily have a long history of a large Asian American community, but lots of people did come after, you know, 1965 when immigration laws were reformed. So a lot of folks, for instance, worked for, like Eli Lilly, right? So, the people I knew in the Asian American community, a lot of them were, you know, from the parents were, you know, highly educated and et cetera. So anyway, learning about the model minority concept was very interesting to me as a, you know, college sophomore. And I also got more deeply involved in, you could call it, I guess, Asian American activism on campus. Mm. And all of that really led me to, abandon my plans for going to medical school after I also very good at, you know, science. And I decided that I wanted to maybe one day become like a historian or something along those lines. So I went to UCLA and I got a master's in Asian American studies. Mm. From there, I did decide, you know, this is something I want to try. And so I ended up doing a PhD in American history. Mm. At the University of Chicago, where I studied with then a new assistant professor named May Nye, who of course now is, you know, one of the probably the foremost historian of, you know, immigration to the United States. And So when I started thinking about a dissertation topic, I knew I wanted to do something in Asian American history. And at this time, this was like around 1999-2000. And I was, so two things happened. The first was that I took an amazing seminar on post-World War II American society with Professor George Chauncey. Did in this period, like from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And then I also, knowing Asian American studies scholarship, and there was so much about the mono-minority, what's called the mono-minority myth, which is essentially critical scholarship about this stereotype and its harmful implications. But very little had been done on the historical, on its historical emergence, right? Didn't know much about that. And so that's how I ended up working on this topic, which was first my dissertation and then, over time became my book.
So what was that term you used earlier, the Hoosier Chino, however you described yourself before?
Hoosier Chino is just my way of saying, a Chinese American from Indiana, I guess.
Oh, okay. I was going to open up actually asking about the model minority myth. It seems like many critiques have been made about the myth since the 1960s. What was it about the myth that you felt was missing, or that you felt like historical analysis could really add to our understanding of it?
That's a great question. I think the number one thing that I felt unsatisfied by the explanations at the time that I began my dissertation was that conventionally in Asian American studies, scholars have, rightfully pointed out that the model minority myth became used by basically, white people as a way to, discipline Black people, right? Or as a way to counter the claims of activists in the Black freedom movement. But I think what has always been missing in that narrative is Asian Americans themselves, right? I wasn't ready to believe that this was something. And often the story is told like, the first time we heard about the mono minority was in this 1966 article by William Peterson in the New York Times magazine. And then another article that same year in U.S. News World Report. But, as a historian, I was very skeptical. Like, how could those articles, those articles had to come from somewhere, right? And again, I wanted to understand Asian Americans' own role in the creation of this new image. I just couldn't believe that their Asian Americans had no place in the process. So that was kind of my entry point into this.
So to kind of get at this history, to get at the various attitudes that helped produce this myth, you consider the post World War II period. I think that's the period you're mostly dealing with as one of racial liberalism. I've heard other scholars like Jody Melamed use this term racial liberalism before, but can you tell us a bit about what that is and how it emerged?
Sure. So racial liberalism. So liberalism is a political philosophy that has run through the course of American history. And liberalism, I mean, it's a slippery concept because it's so, I guess, big, it's so capacious. But what historians generally understand liberalism to be kind of based on a few core concepts, such as freedom and what's called rational self-interest, and also a belief in human progress. Okay, so over the course of U.S. history, liberalism has taken different forms. And by the 1940s, liberalism came to encompass a real emphasis on the assimilation and integration of racial minorities. So race wasn't necessarily a big part of liberalism, I would say. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but this particular aspect of race in terms of assimilation integration really came to the fore in the 1940s, in large part because of the United States' ambitions in the world, right? The U.S. was fighting first in World War II against the Nazis and the fascists, and then in the Cold War against the communists, and the United States really thought itself to be this leader of the free world. But it also, American political leaders also were quite aware that people around the world, including, you know, the, let's say in the World War II in Japan or like the Soviet Union during the Cold War, people around the world were very critical of the United States making these claims to be this, you know, shining beacon of democracy mm-hmm. when racial minorities were treated so terribly, right, domestically, right at home. So I think this is really the period when racial liberalism takes off and lots of Americans decide that, you know, they need to solve the racial problem at home. And the way they're going to solve it is through this real emphasis on assimilation, mm-hmm. innovation.
It seems like that word assimilation, though, seems to change a bit towards the word inclusion. Like that seems to be the big kind of catchphrase of a lot of the discourse here that, you know, they're not quite being like made totally American, but they're being included. And it feels like that's like an important part of the book that we're kind of taught to think once you include somebody in something, race kind of goes away in some ways. But you focus a lot on inclusion as a different kind of mode of power, mm-hmm. I think, for racial liberal. Can you tell us a bit about maybe what you're going for there, like how inclusion does that?
Yeah, I think, you know, scholars, I'll just say in Asian American history, for instance, recent scholarship has really emphasized, and here I'm thinking of people like Ichiro Zimura Mainai, that, you know, exclusion and inclusion in sort of the national community, if we can say it like that, right, the national polity, they're not these like mutually exclusive processes, or, you know, it's not like American history has just gotten better, you know, America has just gotten better over time, and that, you know, the circle of inclusion just keeps on widening, right? But I think in the book, I really wanted to show that, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, powerful people and ordinary people alike really move to kind of include people of Asian ancestry sort of in the American national community. But a lot of the motivation for doing this was this understanding that Asians were somehow still different, right? Mm-hmm. And difference in the exclusion era had justified, you know, bars to immigration or naturalization or terrible, you know, violence and segregation. But in this period beginning in World War II, that difference is now, a lot of people now see that difference as an asset. For example, it's a way for the U.S. to kind of make connections to, you know, Asia during the Cold War and try to win these Asian countries to the U.S. side of the rivalry with the Soviet Union. Hmm.
Yeah, just to kind of follow from that, during that same period, it also seemed crucial to, as you kind of put it in the book, to break the white-black binary, but that we shouldn't all like immediately celebrate, you know, disrupting that binary, because what ends up happening, as you say, with the model minority myth, is it defines Asian Americans as definitively not black, and you kind of imply also like not these other, you know, ethnic race, not Hispanic as well. It seems that we kind of have a habit of just reading Asian America as well as other minority groups with comparing them immediately to white Anglo-Americans. Mm-hmm. But what happens, do you think, when we start focusing on these other groups? And how did, in whose interest is it, I guess, that they were characterized as not black or as definitively not black?
I think that's a great question. And I think it's an uncomfortable one in some ways, right? Because I think that today, for instance, you know, there are a lot of, we could call them progressive Asian Americans, myself included, I suppose. You know, we have a lot of investment in claiming this identity as people of color, right? And sort of talking and demonstrating how we are allies with all these groups like African Americans or Latinas, Native Americans, etc. But what I wanted to show in the book was that, I guess I should first say that, you know, the argument I make in the book is that by the 1960s, or one of the arguments, that Asian Americans come to be, you know, Americans come to racialize Asian Americans as what I call definitively not black. Hmm. And I think I don't know. I wouldn't say that Asian Americans, you know, started off during World War II having this particular goal in mind. In a lot of ways, it was intended consequence. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is a kind of so for Asian Americans themselves, I think that since then there has been a kind of in a way, a kind of social capital, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, Asian Americans, of course, we experience racism in lots of different ways, but the racism that I think Asian Americans face today, you know, still looks different than, if my crude, you know, in very crude way saying, than the kinds of racism that disproportionately affects, let's say, African American communities, for instance, you know, the high rates of incarceration, right? It is not the same kinds of problems. And, you know, I think this is actually a current debate right now raging sort of on Twitter and such about, well, is there such a thing as Asian American privilege, et cetera? And so that's something, you know, I can't answer for sure because I haven't yet studied that period. But backtracking to the 40s through the 60s, I think that this new stereotype of Asian Americans, I did benefit, I guess, the United States as a whole, or the people in power and the people who wanted to, in some ways, either maintain the kind of domestic status quo or expand U.S. power overseas. And that is to say that having a group like Asian Americans and being able to point to them and say that there is a minority, there are minorities in America, racial minorities in American society that seem to, you know, do well or quote unquote assimilate without problem, is a way to say, you know, isn't America so great? And, you know, we really don't need to fix, like, we don't have the problems of race are not deep structural problems. They're problems of culture, right? And if people just behave in a certain way, then they'll be fine.
Hmm. Yeah. That seems to be one of the backbones of racial liberalism, is it starts to turn everything towards culture. And I wanted to ask a quick question about your method, because as I was reading through the book, there's so much detailed information and so many anecdotes, like just that are a pleasure to read. But it does seem like a lot of research, and I'm just curious if you can tell us about your method in collecting the data, what types of archives you found yourself pulling from most. You take a lot from speeches, a lot from and a lot from newspapers and all sorts of newspapers all around the U.S. So can you tell us a bit about your experience doing research for the project?
Sure. As far as the research methods for the book, I would say that, you know, if you're to historians, I would say that it's kind of this mashup of like political history, social history, cultural history. And by that, I mean that I really try to look at sort of both what was happening on the ground in Asian American communities, as well as what was happening outside of Asian American communities. So in some ways, this book is trying to tell these different stories. Like it's trying to tell about what's happening within, like, let's say, Chinese American or Japanese American communities at the time, and the sort of power struggles that people had, right? And so for that, I used ethnic newspapers. I used organizational and personal papers. So, and let me think what else. I would say those were the main ones. I also relied heavily, for instance, on there's an archive at UCLA called the Japanese American Research Project. Mm-hmm. And so I use a lot of that documentation, and especially the papers of a group called the Japanese American Citizens League. Mm. And then as far as looking at sort of larger society as a whole, I relied heavily on, you know, the mainstream press. So big, you know, kind of major newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, major magazines, you know, Life Magazine, Look Magazine, that kind of stuff, Newsweek and Time. Mm-hmm. I also did a lot of research at the National Archives. So I used government documents, like the papers of the State Department, for instance, congressional records, congressional debates, a lot of the documentation that came out of the World War II Japanese American internment experience. And I'm trying to think if I missed anything else. And then sort of like just different things here and there. Japanese American internment camp newspapers, the organizational papers of like the Chicago the Chicago Resettlers Collect, you know, the resettlement organization, and you know, the Hawaii State Archives and the Hawaii Statehood Commission. So this research actually took me to a lot of places around the country.
Didn't you end up doing any interviews for the book? Or because there seems like so many people from this era still alive. Or, you know, did people from this era particularly influence your writing?
I did. I would say I sort of shied away from doing an extensive oral history interviews, but mm-hmm. was really lucky. In 2003, I actually sat down to have a conversation with Jade Snow Wong. Mm. And she, you know, she's really nice because I didn't know her. I just like random graduate student. I wrote her a letter and she called me. She's like, come on over to my travel agency. So we talked for a while. And, you know, I'm sure that she had been interviewed to death, but she was gracious enough to talk to me. I also had a great conversation with a woman named Betty Lee Sung, who is a retired sociology professor from City College of New York. And Betty Lee Sung did a lot of groundbreaking research on Asian Americans during her time. And she also, interestingly, did a radio show in the 40s and 50s for Voice of America. And the radio show was about Chinese Americans. So that was what I was most interested in talking to her about. I also had sort of email correspondence, and I met in person this wonderful woman named Setsuko Matsunaga Nishi, who was a sociologist for decades and really did groundbreaking research on Japanese Americans. And so she really, I didn't do a formal interview of her, but she really helped me especially steer the first chapter of the book, which is about the resettlement of Japanese Americans mm-hmm. from the camps, and she was heavily involved with that at the time.
Let's go right into that first chapter. I found it really fascinating. I liked the pictures of Japanese Americans in zoot suits. I thought that was interesting, and the whole the War Relocation Authority relocating Japanese, and also, you know, having this chance or this creating the conditions of possibility, I suppose, to recreate Japanese identity after internment, to do it in a at least by the WRA, it seems, in a very deliberate way, as a response to the kind of growing youth movement. So can you tell us a bit about the WRA, the War Relocation Authority, and how they attempted to refashion ethnic Japanese into kind of model Americans?
Yes. And so this goes back to your question about racial liberalism, Chris. So, you know, we often think of Japanese American internment as and rightfully so, as this terrible and tragic experience that robbed people of so many things, like their civil liberties and their freedoms and their lives. But the people who ran the War Relocation Authority, that was the civilian agency under the Department of the Interior that, you know, managed the, you know, administered the concentration camps, they had other goals. You know, they definitely, what they talked about at the time, they talked about how they did not want to end up with what they called something akin to Indian reservation. They didn't want to have this permanent population of Japanese, like in the desert or whatever. So their idea was to use this opportunity to Americanize the Japanese American prisoners, and then in time, sort of prepare them to assimilate into mainstream American society. So what they wanted to avoid actually was also for Japanese Americans to return to the West Coast, to return to the little Tokyo enclaves, right? But they had this fantasy of, you know, of sort of having Japanese Americans disappear into the middle class and like sort of scattered all over the country. Mm-hmm. Not live around each other, but they would live around, you know, white middle class people. So, so in 1943, the War Relocation Authority began what was called the Resettlement Project, and the idea here was to start, you know, first of all, finding. You know, they hope to find jobs for Japanese Americans in places like Chicago and Denver and New York, and then, you know, kind of slowly start to let these Japanese American internees out into the real world and have them, you know, assimilate in like good Americans. And interestingly, this meant that when let's say you were a young, you know, person who wanted to leave camp and take a job in Chicago, like in a factory or something, you would still have to go through what was called a interview. And the War Relocation Authority would sit down, interview internees and ask them, like, do they promise, you know, not to hang out in groups of Japanese people more than like two or three at a time in public? And they were supposed to, you know, promise not to speak Japanese, you know, in public, or do Japanesey things, and or just like draw attention to themselves. OK, the idea, again, is to make them very, you know, inconspicuous. Right. And then if they passed these interviews, then they were allowed to go. And so in this first chapter, this first chapter is basically about this resettlement project, but how a group of some young Japanese Americans who, you know, were zoot suiters basically, really presented a problem for the resettlement project, because of course they were in some ways the very opposite of what they were told to do by the government, which is, you know, kind of blend in and don't be, you know, don't stand out, right? Because they're standing out. They're wearing these zoot suits, and they're also, and not just the zoot suiters, but a lot of young Japanese American resettlers often ended up doing the opposite of what they were told to do by the government, right? Mm. They were not to hang out with each other. And also, a lot of the Japanese Americans, they would accept jobs. They would, you know, jobs as, you know, housekeepers or factory workers. And sometimes they didn't like their jobs and they would just quit, you know, and they wouldn't tell their employers. And, you know, the WRA was just horrified because they felt like doing that just gave Japanese Americans a bad name, right? A bad image. And so this chapter is really about, in the end, you know, sort of, contrary to what the federal government had hoped, in places like Chicago, Japanese Americans, you know, by the late 1940s, actually, in some ways, reconstituted an ethnic community. You know, in Chicago, they had Japanese American organizations, you know, clubs, basketball teams, this kind of thing, and even the federal authorities over time conceded that maybe this was the best thing for Japanese Americans in the time being, right? Because they had just gone through this traumatic experience. But, you know, over time, in the end goal was still assimilation into the white middle class.
Mm-hmm. So much of it seems driven by this kind of anxiety that, you know, oh, we just incarcerated all these people. You know, what are they going to do as a kind of response?
And
you follow up on that with how Japanese Americans themselves started to respond to this. I mean, you talk quite a bit about how there was a lot of diversity politically in Asian America, but it kind of gets drowned out by the JACL and some other organizations. So can you tell us a bit about the response to this and how the JACL either kind of continued the WRA's model or, you know, refashioned it in other ways?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this goes back to the earlier point I made about, I wanted to know what were the roles of Asian Americans in, you know, ultimately fashioning or inventing this model minority image. And the Japanese American Citizens League, the Japanese American Citizens League, I'll try to say this very briefly, was a group of second generation or what were called Nisei Americans who came of age in the 20s and 1920s and 1930s. And they understood that their prospects for living in an American society weren't great at the time, right? And so they did a lot of things to try to prove to other Americans that they were worthy of being included and recognized as American citizens. And when World War II broke out, a lot of the first generation, the immigrant generation, those leaders were put behind bars or otherwise silenced, right? Because the government could sort of accuse them of having these ties to Japan. So the JACL leadership sort of stepped in into this leadership vacuum in the community. And I would say that they weren't terribly popular at the time. You know, other people also tried to step in, but the JACL managed to do it. And then they started to see themselves as like the spokespersons for the Japanese American community, or like the intermediaries between the community, that is the incarcerated population, and the federal government. And so one of, and this was very controversial because a lot of the people in the community did not see the JCL in that way. The JCL were some of the first people to heavily push for the idea of military service as a way for Japanese Americans to prove their patriotism, loyalty, and their, you know, worthiness for being recognized as full Americans. And so they worked with the WRA, that is the War Relocation Authority, and other federal agencies to begin, first of all, they thought they could get a volunteer, you know, kind of an all-volunteer Japanese-American regiment. Over time, they ended up drafting people because they just couldn't get enough volunteers. So the third chapter of my book really traces what I call the birth of the Nisei, that is the Japanese-American soldier. And this is not to diminish, you know, I don't mean to diminish the actual battlefield sacrifices that real people made. I mean, those were very real, and lots of people, lots of Japanese Americans lost their lives fighting this war. But I think I was really more interested in how military service became a kind of strategy, a kind of public relations strategy for the Japanese American community. And I should say that, again, it was very controversial and a very unpopular decision among many Japanese Americans. So the JCL was always very controversial in its decision making. So after World War II, the JCL continued to push this Nisei soldier concept, right? The idea that Japanese Americans were loyal and they had fought in the war. And because of that, they deserved rewards. They deserved, for instance, the rights to naturalization for their parents who were barred from naturalization. They deserved, JCL also called for an end to Japanese exclusion law so that immigrants could, come from Japan again. Mm-hmm. The JCL also pushed very heavily for the Japanese American community to get, reparations for its monetary financial losses during the internment and other kinds of, other kinds of civil rights reforms. And I guess I've lost my train of thought.
I'm just curious if the JCL in the kind of discourse that they had at the time, were they also relying on culture, cultural background as kind of one of the reasons why they were this kind of model American or the model soldiers?
I think, yes, over time they do. So the JCL has two projects after World War II. And the first is to what I call, rehabilitate rehabilitate the image of Japanese Americans as a whole, right, in the eyes of American society. But its other simultaneous project is to rehabilitate its own, that is the League's own image within the Japanese American community. So those two things are happening at the same time. And one of the ways that they try to do it is to help tell the story in the 1950s of Japanese Americans' amazing recovery from the trauma of internment. And over time, not just the JCL, but, mainstream journalists and social scientists start to try to explain how is it that Japanese Americans within a couple of decades managed to seem to do so well, right, and get over it. And there were JCL and other folks did use cultural explanation so that by the mid-1960s, in the throes of the Black Freedom Movement, you have people like the JCL and then other mainstream commentators, social scientists, and journalists comparing Japanese Americans to African Americans and basically saying, Japanese Americans possess a certain stable of cultural traits, right? Mm-hmm. That they are from Meiji Japan, like, reverence for education and strong families. And they, they worked hard and they didn't really complain. They kind of kept their heads down. And that helps to, that explains why they seem to be doing so well a generation after, two decades after internment.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting in some of the records that you pull, the internment was kind of compared a lot to slavery. For African Americans, that, why did it take Blacks so long to, as you kind of put it, like, in that language, to get over something? And so there was always this implicit, like, oh, they came back from tragedy so fast,
Yes.
So let's move to Chinese Americans and how the afterlife of World War II kind of impacted them differently than the Japanese, because for them it seems like right after World War II they have this opportunity to define themselves against Japanese, but then the Korean War starts and the Cold War starts, and it becomes almost like they're kind of living what the Japanese lived through in a way.
They are. I think the key difference for the Chinese in some ways was that in terms of international relations, you know, China had split into good China and bad China, right? So bad China was, you know, mainland, the People's Republic of China after the, you know, Communist Revolution of 1949. And so all of a sudden, the PRC, I'll just call it the PRC, the People's Republic of China, was now this like major enemy of the United States. On the other hand, the nationalist Chinese, that is the political party defeated in the Chinese Civil War that has fled to Taiwan, right? And and it called itself the Republic of China, and its leader was, you know, Chiang Kai-shek. The Republic of China, the nationalists, became an important U.S. ally, right, during this period, the 40s, the 50s, of the early part of the Cold War. So, you know, Chinese in the U.S. never were able to shake off the idea that they were somehow still foreign, even as they were accepted as more American. But in some ways, I guess you might say, fortuitously for them, this foreignness wasn't all like the scary enemy by the 40s and 50s, because now there was, you know, a good Chinese ally in Taiwan. So what I look at in the book are anti-communist crusade in the Americans' Chinatowns beginning in the early 1950s. So at the time when the People's Republic of China enters the Korean War on the side of the North Koreans, right, the Chinese in the U.S. start to really worry that they're going to end up in the same situation that Japanese Americans did during World War II. So Chinese American leaders really do a lot of things to try to signal to other Americans that they're patriotic and loyal and above all anti-communist. So they have all these, they establish all these anti-communism clubs in Chinatowns. They have lots and lots of parades, like anti-communist demonstrations. And they, you know, they just, and for the actually the leaders of Chinatown are quite conservative, and they're also, they're interested in doing this because it gives them also a reason to I don't know what the word is, to try to weaken the Chinatown left, right? And that works out well for them because it's the McCarthyist era. They can work with the FBI and the INS to try to weed out leftists in the Chinese American community. In this particular chapter, I also talk about the State Department, the U.S. State Department, and how, so going along with this recent spate of what's called Cold War civil rights scholarship in U.S. historiography, I became interested in how the United States State Department deployed Chinese Americans as cultural diplomats, especially during the 1950s, right? And they would they used people like Jade Snow Wong, this other famous artist at the time named Don Kingman. He was a famous watercolorist painter. Also, the San Francisco Chinese basketball team. You know, these folks were among the folks who were sent by the State Department abroad to showcase, especially to overseas Chinese communities in the Asian Pacific Rim, but other communities like people in, you know, India and Pakistan, for instance, that, you know, the United States was a welcoming place for its minorities, including Asian Americans.
It does seem interesting how aggressive the Chinese American communities are in naming themselves as more Taiwanese or as more capitalist. Like in some of the quotes you provide, they're literally like saying we should go more into business. You know, we should become more economically successful because that will prove that we're not communists. You know, it's interesting to politicize that move into the economic sphere as, you know, as this kind of anti-communist. It's almost like it's a survival trait, right? We have to do this or otherwise we will be interned, you know?
In some ways I thought, who could blame them? You know, I think all Americans were kind of had this fearful of being accused of being communist, you know, mm-hmm. in the 90s, right? That was very real. And I think Chinese Americans had seen what had just happened to Japanese Americans. So you have to add the racial element on top of that. And in some ways, I really empathize with that impulse to try extra hard to prove to, you know, Americans, you know, other people that, you know, you don't need to be incarcerated or anything, right? That you're loyal to America.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into the second half of your book, which is more about how Asian Americans were then typified as non-Black, or as definitively non-Black, especially during the 1960s and the civil rights movements and all that was happening. And it does seem like at this point, especially here in the early 1970s, the Asian American left starts to gain a bit more clout, political clout, or at least a bit more of a voice.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit about how that happened and how the Asian Americans themselves responded to this, like, to the kind of culture, the idea that their culture was somehow superior to the others, and that's what made them, you know, more successful in the U.S.?
Okay, sure. So maybe I'll just backtrack just a little bit to talk about how the idea sort of take hold, right? And I think, again, as I mentioned earlier, on the one hand, there's you know, a lot of people are wringing their hands, and I'm just talking about overall in America about what was called the Negro problem, and then eventually we knew as the, you know, civil rights or Black power, right? And so in the case of the Japanese, as I already explained, certain observers start to compare Japanese America's rebound from internment with, you know, obviously the problems that African Americans faced. In terms of Chinese Americans, so again, the Chinese Americans are very worried about what might happen to them in the context of the Cold War, the Korean War, and McCarthyism. And so one idea that Chinese Americans, like spin doctors basically, community leaders, really try to put out there in sort of the public conversation is this idea that Chinese Americans have model families, right? And that children never get into trouble. And this really resonates with lots of Americans in the 50s because nationwide there's a whole panic or scare about juvenile delinquency. And so in the 50s, especially, we see lots of articles and newspapers and magazines, you know, commentary by even U.S. congressmen about how these Chinese American families are great because their children are so behaved. And this idea really takes hold. And by the 60s, again, we get people like, for instance, Assistant Secretary of Labor Daniel Patrick Moynihan, right? He's the one that this infamous, I guess, Moynihan Report that basically, you know, he's a liberal and what he's trying to, he's a liberal, he's a racial liberal. So he's basically suggesting that if Black people just behave more like white middle class people, we might be able to get rid of Black poverty, right? So again, he's making a cultural argument about a cultural type of proposal for solving the problem of Black poverty. And he gets really criticized for doing this in the 60s, like the mid 60s. And one way that he defends himself really is pointing to the Chinese and the Japanese and saying, look, again, here are some minority groups. They have, you know, the right kind of culture, i.e., and therefore they're doing well, right, in America. And at the same time, what we start to see in the late 60s and 70s is really the birth of the Asian American movement. And so if in the 50s, for instance, and the early 60s, the Chinatown or the Chinese and Japanese American liberal to left, you know, in some ways, the JCLs, they are liberals, right? They're racial liberals too. Mm-hmm. But there are people more on the left, like the Nisei progressives, and then folks on the Chinatown left that are not as, you know, it's not a good time for them. But by the late 60s and early 70s, you know, there is a coming together of this Asian American progressives left in the Asian American movement. And one thing I think that really draws people together is actually critiquing this model minority idea and its consequences, right? The idea that the model minority is a way to denigrate Black people, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Native Americans. And it's also a way to help further the cause of American expansionism or imperialism, right? Mm-hmm. So, and people in the Asian American movement were very much drawn together in their opposition to the Vietnam War. So it is really this important moment in Asian American history, right? And I think one in some ways that comes out of this earlier history of this immediately preceding history of the emergence of the model minority concept.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting how unexpected that gets for some, like that they would ally with these other racial groups, because there's been so much work, it seems, on making them seem distinct, decades earlier. But let's, since we're running a bit low on time, let's move to your last chapter, which is on Hawaii.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting because you break away a bit from the historical story you've been telling, and you deal mostly with Hawaii as it became a state and all the conversations around that. But it does become this really fascinating moment. And I feel like people who write about racial liberalism and pluralism don't really consider Hawaii. And that's always kind of weird when they do that, because it just seems so like integral to the story of how that concept develops. So I was really happy to see that the last chapter is on Hawaii. But how do you feel Hawaii adds to the story and adds to our kind of conceptions of model minority myth and Asian Americans in the U.S.?
Okay, let me try to digest that question. I mean, I think that as I started revising my dissertation into this book, I realized I couldn't tell this story without looking at Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because the argument that I make in this chapter is that in some ways, the question of Hawaii's statehood, because Hawaii was so heavily populated by people of Asian ancestry, that the question in the 40s and 50s, should Hawaii become a state, in some way served as basically a referendum, a national referendum on what Americans thought about Asians. You know, in other words, it's kind of symbolic. Like, do Asian Americans deserve to be included as full citizens, right, in our national polity? And so I really want to argue that, you know, we can try to answer that question through the lens of Hawaii statehood. And why it's important to the story too is because it pulls together a lot of the themes of the book, right? It's a Cold War story in that people who were pro-statehood at this time felt like the reason to admit Hawaii is because it is very different than the other parts of the mainland U.S., right? It is kind of foreign-ish, but that foreignness is an asset in fighting the Cold War, because people talked about it as being this bridge to Asia, right? Like, the people there were somehow naturally qualified to serve as these ambassadors to Asia. And that's why Hawaii need to be admitted into the U.S. And the other thing that's important about the history of Hawaii is that for so long, I mean, I shouldn't say for so long, but since the early 20th century, because of its ethnic and racial diversity, some people had celebrated Hawaii as this kind of melting pot, right? And they didn't have, you know, there's a lot of intermarriage in Hawaii. So you see a lot of race mixing there that you don't see in the U.S. mainland. And again, I mean, that on one hand, that was very worrisome to people like Strom Thurmond, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of in public anyway, doesn't want to see people, you know, sleeping with people of other races or whatever. But I think Hawaii, for some people, racial liberals, in some ways represented the best of what America might become, right? Which is sort of this kind of racial paradise where people supposedly get along and marry across racial lines. And, you know, there's all these mixed race people and such. And so over time, that story of Hawaii as racial paradise becomes part of this model minority story. And then, Daniel Inouye is the first representative. He's American after Hawaii becomes a state, and Hiram Fong is Chinese American. He's one of the first senators. And so there was a lot of attention at the time on Hawaii. And, I end the book, one of the moments, the book kind of ends in this place where, for instance, Senator Daniel Inouye is giving the speech at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. He talks about, people ask him, why can't African Americans be more like you, right? You know, be more like Japanese Americans, like, look how successful you are. And so I wanted to tell this story about how, in some ways, these little, I guess, these different regional racial orders in Hawaii, in the U.S. West, in the North, in the South, in some ways they get drawn together by the latter half of the 20th century. And we can see that happening in the history, in this particular case, in the Hawaii statehood story, you know, so that Honolulu starts to become to be talked about as not being like Newark or Detroit, right? And not having the same problems that the racial problems that we see in these kind of northern urban cities. And I also wanted to bring this story into you, I should say, because observers start to celebrate Asian Americans as like the future of Hawaii's estate, and that Native Hawaiians are sort of part of its vanishing past, right? Mm-hmm. So I also want to show that the model minority concept isn't always just about, you know, denigrating African Americans, but it does other things too. And in this particular moment, it's about Native Hawaiians as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Let's move right into your coda where you kind of give some more purpose to the argument by displaying how the model minority myth continues to affect Asian Americans, how it's changed. And of course, throughout the book, just because I'm living now, you know, I kept thinking of figures like Amy Chua. And then you do mention her in the coda as someone who seems to be re-evolving or reiterating parts of this myth.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about how we should see this history for today and how we can look at figures like her?
Uh-huh. Well, I think, you know, I think Amy Chua and I have a complicated relationship with her. And in some ways, I have to say, I appreciate what she's doing because it's so, first of all, I mean, obviously, it's kind of outlandish, right? Like mm-hmm. her recent book and everything and the Tiger Mom thing. But because she has made such a splash in recent times, it has opened us up a space for us to think about these issues of race and assimilation and, you know, and then also who gets to speak for the community, right? Which is a lot of thematically what's going on in the book. And yeah, I would say that it might not be the most popular argument, but one of the points I really want to make in the conclusion of the book is that, you know, in order to really dismantle the model minority concept, we actually have to recognize the political diversity of Asian America. And that does include folks like Amy Chua and other people who embrace this model minority concept and try to, you know, work hard at, you know, perpetuating it, basically. But I try to end in some ways on a hopeful note, too, to say, you know, we also are living at a very exciting time as Asian Americans in that, I would say, even in the last decade, the range of representations in popular culture has just really opened up in so many unexpected and exciting ways, right? Who would have thought, I would never even thought 10 years ago we'd see someone like Mindy Kaling, right, a South Asian American woman who isn't like model skinny, as people always point out, right? Have her own, you know, show on Fox, Harold and Kumar and Lynn Sanity and all those examples. And so, yeah, I really think that in so many ways, unfortunately, Asian Americans today are still very much, we're still confined or constricted, restricted by this model minority concept. But I also think we are starting to see a lot more ways in which people are able to just kind of get beyond that paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Let's go right. So I think we've taken up a lot of your time. Are you working on any new research now? I mean, this book just came out, so that might be a nerve-wracking question. But what do you have in mind later down the road?
Well, later down the road, my newest project that I'm trying to launch, in some ways we could call, it's sort of a sequel to this book, right? In that I want to look at Asian Americans in the age of affirmative action. So beginning in the 60s and taking it up through the present or at least very recent past. And what I'm really curious about is how Asian Americans are very anomalous in kind of Asian affirmative action and other kinds of, you know, racial policies, I guess we could call them. And most specifically, I'm calling this project overrepresented because Asian Americans are generally not thought of as so-called underrepresented minorities. And I'm really curious to see how that logic came about, right? It's not natural necessarily. So I really want to know the historical roots of that kind of thinking and then how it sort of, you know, has worked in tandem with new immigration from Asia and, you know, Latin America and a kind of very different and complex racial landscape in the late 20th century.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very interesting. I always have students, you know, that Asian American students who will ask me like why they don't get the same I guess they don't get to go to the same resources as the underrepresented minority students, you know, when they still identify as people of color. So there's, you know, it, on one hand, yeah, there is a, like a statistical over, like not overrepresentation, but fair, I guess, fairer. And then there's also this splitting of, you know, of the communities, you know, where race, cross-racial solidarity seems less likely.
Right. So, I mean, in some ways, I think it makes a good project because there's no easy answers. So it will take me years and years to figure out some kind of, you know, explanation for that. But
okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Thank you for contacting me. This is a really great read. It's very big and very complex. Like, just every single chapter seems to have its own stories and anecdotes. So thank you so much for writing, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for your time, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to my interview with Ellen Wu and her book, The Color of Success. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, you can message me on the New Books in Asian American Studies Facebook page. See you next time.